Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I have another two-hour show for all of you. The first hour focused a lot more on the broad markets. We're going to bounce around, talk about some of the other major moves, including, or some other, let's call them significant moves in the bond market, also commodities, probably talk a little bit about currencies too. I am kicking off this show with Rick Bensignor. He is the president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes his institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors, and also writes the In the Know Trader for the retail audience, and just started that new piece called 7-Eleven, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs. Rick, before we get into actual market moves, I want to have a general discussion with you regarding the disconnect that we continue to see between, let's say, Main Street and U.S. equity markets. You and I were chatting before we recorded this about some of the businesses that were shutting down in our areas. You more in New York, me in Vancouver. We are seeing a lot of small businesses struggle, but you wouldn't know that. You wouldn't see that if you were just looking at the U.S. equity market. Look, this isn't new where markets don't exactly correlate to the underlying economy, but what's important to note about the disconnect currently here, Rick?
So, Corey, thanks for having me. I like the question that you're starting off with because there is this disconnect, very much so when you look at the, let's use the stock market and the fact that a week ago Friday, we were on all-time highs. And we're off, I don't know, 2/3% or so this week, nothing big. But, you know, to Main Street, when they turn on the TV or read a newspaper and they see where the market is, and they're probably like going, what the heck's going on out here? You know, it's not reflective at all of my life, my family's life, my friend's life. You know, how can the market be saying things are so good when we're all struggling so much and so many small businesses are not going to survive this? I know in New York, they're already talking about 50% of the restaurants in New York City will close permanently. I mean, that's a huge hit on an economy. Closing New York City schools this week, as the mayor did, hurts those that have managed to survive because they need, you know, breakfast crowd, lunch crowd. And I'm not talking high-end restaurants necessarily, but just all the places that are categorized as restaurants in the five boroughs that make up New York. So you've got these large capitalized companies that go public and are publicly traded, and they're being very well bid up for. At the same time, things are very questionable about the economy. And it really is the difference in many ways of the haves and the have-nots. And the fact that the little guy is not represented in the stock market. These are big companies, and they are generally much more able to deal with problems like a global pandemic than, you know, the little guy who owns the hardware store around the corner, or somebody who owns a laundromat, or you know, people who, let's say small business America, you know, Main Street America, the little mom and pop shops that are so much the backbone of the country, are being dramatically affected by people staying home. People are staying home because by and large, they care about their health and they're trying to, you know, stay with guidelines that are being issued. Sometimes they're forced to by state or city mandates. Other times, you know, it's just people like, you know, my wife and I, we'll go out, we'll walk around the block and we'll go to the grocery when we need to get food, but we're not doing anything else. We're not hanging out with friends unless we're sitting outdoors. And now it's starting to get too cold in New York to do that. You know, we live a pretty quiet life right now because we're not going to the movies. We're not socializing and going out to dinner with friends, unless we can do so in a way that is relatively safe. And when you look at what's going on in the stock market, you don't see that because these are big companies and investors are looking past the pandemic at this point. They're looking easily 6 months to a year to 18 months down the road. And with, you know, vaccine breakthroughs, they're saying we know there's still trouble ahead, but we will get past it. And therefore, our stocks that sold off are, you know, so many of them are worth are value-oriented names. There's we're seeing in the last week or two also the transition back into value over growth, something that has not worked at all for years. And you're at least potentially at a turning point in that longer-term trend that suggests that you'll finally see more investors going towards cheaper names. In fact, this past week, when I did my weekly podcast for In the Know Trader, which I do on Tuesdays, and it comes out on, it's available on stockcharts.com at 3 p.m. Eastern time. And it also gets released at the same time onto YouTube. So if you do a search on YouTube for In the Know Trader or my name, Rick Bensignor, you will see every podcast I've done for the last couple of years. And as I say, they come out weekly. And in this week's episode, I actually spent the bulk of it talking about value names and looking at the list of maybe the top dozen or so names that were in the S&P 500 value index. I looked at the ticker IVE, which is an ETF, which is, you know, the S&P value, large cap value. And, you know, I went through a bunch of names kind of saying, here's where I like them, here's where I don't, because there is a move now into some value names. So you might as well kind of take a look at those charts for the first time in a long time and start bidding for some of the names that have been, you know, thrown out months ago and just made quite cheap in, you know, fundamental terms, and some of them just cheap in price terms, too. So, you know, I bought a few stocks for myself, too. I recommended, you know, several of them. And I think this is the difference here between what you see as publicly traded companies and the belief by investors that a year from now will, by and large, be done with this virus. And therefore, they're looking ahead versus Main Street America, which says, you know, I can't look a year down the road. I don't even know if I can survive another 2 months in business. So there's a very different mind frame and sense of, you know, investing when it comes to even what individuals are doing versus what pension funds and corporations and hedge funds and mutual funds are doing, because they have different time frames and they're different markets. You know, you can't invest in Joe's hardware store down around the corner. You can go and buy things there, but you can't invest in it. And those who are in the investment industry are looking out ahead. We know the stock market is a forward-looking mechanism, and that's what they're doing. And so their investors in the stock market are trying to look beyond what's still ahead of us. And it's you know, kind of hard when you're living through the thick of this illness that and this virus that's going all over the place. It's very hard to when you're thinking, how am I going to feed my family? And put a roof over their head and send a kid to college and marry off my daughter. How do you do that when, you know, I don't know if I can survive another 2 months? So it's a good question. There is definitely a difference between what investable securities are saying and what, you know, non-investable people who own non-investable stores are feeling.
Rick, do you see any lifeline being available to any of these companies, these smaller companies, either through some sort of government funding bill or who knows, people getting back to some sort of their daily life?
Well, today is an interesting day to ask that question, just given what kind of the main news story of the day is, and that Treasury Secretary Mnuchin has basically said he's ending many of these programs that were had money appropriated by Congress to help businesses. And he's basically saying there's still plenty of money left in that pot that hasn't been allocated or appropriated. And I'm going to return it to Congress. I have the right to do it. I've done what needed to be done. I heard him talk to Jim Cramer this morning and say, you know, look, Boeing, which could have gone under, we didn't, as a government, need to lend them a penny. They were able to get it through the capital markets themselves and private funding. And now, you know, the stock managed to, especially in the last week and a half, has really, you know, made a material move higher of probably 30% or so. And, you know, it was successful. And there's programs like that where we've turned the corner, at least economy-wise, And that's what our Treasury Secretary is essentially saying, such that I can take all these extra funds that haven't been disbursed yet and send them back to the government. And then in the future, Congress can reappropriate funds as needed. The left-leaning New York Times, you know, came out and said it's a very politically induced type move by the Treasury Secretary. Saying that it's simply a Republican move to make it more difficult for Democrats slash Biden to succeed in the future, to which Mnuchin said, not at all. This is not political at all. This is simply there's all these funds that have not been dispersed and we might as well, you know, give them back and let Congress reappropriate them at a future date if needed. The Fed's not happy about it. They came out with a statement, and Mnuchin and Jay Powell have gotten along quite well over time, but this is the first time where the Fed's saying kind of like, we wish you didn't do that. It's going to make it much harder to get money into the system down the road. But that's, you know, that's what's occurred. So is there going to be money in the system to help people in the future? I don't know. After today's announcement, I think Congress would do everything they could to reappropriate down the road, but it's kind of like, you know, anybody knows who's worked in a corporate environment. When budgets are filled out at the beginning of the year and resources allocated, many of the divisions that get those resources allocated will use them up purposely to make sure it shows that, you know, we asked for X amount of dollars, we got it, and we spent it. And it's much harder in the future to get that same money if you don't spend what you were allocated. And, you know, I kind of see this as a trickle through in the same way that Congress may make it tougher in the future if the Treasury didn't fully allocate all the money that was available to give out, it may be harder down the road. And I think that's what, you know, you're kind of seeing in the market. We're recording this late Friday afternoon. The market's closing in less than 4 minutes and the S&P is down 22 towards the lower part of this week's trading range, simply because, you know, it's Friday and ultimately there's not good news going into the weekend. So to answer the question, is there going to be money going forward? I'd hope so, but I don't know if it's going to be readily available as it has been the last 6 months.
So, Rick, what is your outlook then for U.S. equity markets? Because reading over your newsletter, I know you made a fairly aggressive call just at the tail end of last week regarding U.S. markets that flies in the face of a lot of the bullish scenarios.
Yeah, so the markets closed at all-time highs. And then I wrote my piece Sunday to go out to institutional clients, and I like to send it out late afternoon, early evening. And I purposely pushed hard to get it out before futures opened up at 6 p.m. Eastern time, just not to have whatever direction they were going to start the week off with affect how I was going to play this ball. But through a variety of things that I looked at, despite the market being on all-time highs as of a week ago Friday, I actually put out a call saying this is a very out-of-consensus call to hedge long portfolios here and now. And futures opened up well higher Sunday night. They even got an extra boost Monday morning from the Pfizer news. And I even sold something I rarely do, but I even sold futures for myself to hedge my own portfolio of stocks that, you know, I've amassed over 40 years of investing. And I didn't sell enough futures to fully hedge my book. I didn't want to do that, but I wanted to take some and say, you know, I'm willing to give up the upside, let's say, on a third of my portfolio. So I sell enough futures to equal that much. And all I'm doing is kind of hedging my long-term investing by saying here and now, I think the market can come off. And I've had some people say, you're crazy, we're going much higher. And yeah, we may go much higher. But through a variety of things that I looked at, I just didn't think that was the case, including if you think back to, so I guess it was two Mondays ago when the Pfizer news first came out. Then Moderna's news came out later in the week, and we kept pushing higher. But the Moderna news didn't take out the Pfizer news from a week ago Monday, where the S&P opened like 150 higher. And we only closed 50 higher on the day, but we had this massive gap up two Mondays ago. So I've been using that as a reference point because that those highs in the S&P, and whether it was the cash S&P, the spiders, or the S&P futures, the spiders in the futures actually hit long-term upside targets that have been on my chart since the middle of 2015. I had a 36.62 upside target for the cash and 36.55 for futures. And we hit that in the futures and the spiders, which trade longer hours than the cash index, which is just normal New York Stock Exchange hours. So I hit these targets. This really good news comes out about a vaccine from Pfizer, and we have this huge move higher. And yet the subsequent good news that came out from Moderna and then again earlier this week from Pfizer didn't get nearly as high as the high from a week ago Monday. And I kind of anticipated that was going to happen, that the market had gotten as much good news as it could possibly get right now. And when the second wave of good news came and then the third wave of good news, all relating to vaccines came out, they still couldn't take out the high from the first good news. And I kind of anticipated that to happen and that people are leaning the wrong way right now. So that's what got me to kind of come out with the hedge. And the S&P is only down 35 points or so on the week. So it's 1%. It's not a big decline. But there are times I can kind of see where I think it's the right time for institutions to sell some futures or sell spiders, or for individuals to lighten their books to play for some type of decline. So that's what I'm doing now. And, I have the luxury of luckily having put these hedges on the day that made the highest, the all-time high. So I have flexibility here that anywhere I cover these S&P futures lower than I sold them makes me money on the future side. But of course, my book of long stocks is truly losing money. So the hedges there to offset some of the loss. But for right now here, I thought that this was the right time and place to do some selling in the S&P. So that's why I've done it.
All right, fair enough. Let's also talk about commodities. And starting off, let's talk broadly, because right now, base metals, they went through a fairly important, I think, significant breakout, especially copper just on Friday. It's been creeping up for months now, but it reached levels that it hasn't seen since 2014. What is copper and the broad rise in base metals telling you about the underlying markets and money flows?
Well, so here's the same thing. Those markets, some people call copper Dr. Copper. I think that name came out in the 1980s, that it is one of the truest signs of the health of the economy. If you look at a chart of copper, it bottomed in March. It made its highest highs, as you say, in several years this week. And so it's very much kind of followed what stocks have done. So if I look at a chart, I see 2018 front month copper got to 320 or so. So we're right there. Today's 330. And today we got to just about 330 also in December futures. It is suggesting that the economy will do well over time. China is the largest buyer of copper in the world. For quite some time, they've had massive inventory so that they haven't needed to buy. But when I look at the chart, that copper got down to about 210 or so in March, and now it's 330. It's added 50% of its value since March, and which is more than, stocks got to 2,500 or so, 2,400. So they're not so different in their return and even what the charts look like. So the charts would suggest that the economy down the road will do well. But the other side of this that doesn't get talked about by the media, they'll just headline, copper's making highs, is how much commodity markets are fueled directionally by funds that trade them. And most of the funds that trade directionally in commodity markets are pure momentum plays. They generally don't buy sell-offs. They buy rallies and they sell declines. So they go with the direction of the general trend. So a lot of the buying that's being done in copper now is not because copper is the tell-all, end-all, or where that means the economy is going to fly. It's simply funds that come in and allocate to the copper market, X percent of the money they have available, and they may sell out of something else to put money in there, or they might have idle cash. But when you see a commodity that looks, straight up as copper has done since the March low, you're going to see more and more funds be a part of this. So part of it is, in general, the copper market is saying things are improving down the road. But the other piece is how much the funds push these markets.
How about the funds pushing some of the other metal sectors, like precious metals or anything else that you're seeing in the metal sector?
Yeah, so gold peaked several months ago over the summer. And at the time, we identified and said that we think the peak is in for the rest of the year. At first, I said it through Election Day, and then about 2 weeks before Election Day, I said, I think gold is likely done on the upside for the balance of the year. Long-term targets in gold are still well higher. Shorter term, it's had some trouble, but most importantly, it still stays above 1835. We keep bottoming somewhere around 1850, and we get some bounce. So right now we're at December futures are at 1871. So we're only a little bit above, the support level. If we start breaking under 1835, next level is probably 1760, 1770, something like that in there. And then the big support level, which if we got down to is going to hurt a lot of people who are long gold, is all the way down at like 16 and a quarter. And that's where, like on the charts, I'd come in again with what we call in the business, two hands open. Like I'd buy a lot of gold at that point down there. In between, I'm long some gold myself. I've sold out of half. I still have half. I'm trying to figure out if I want to live through a potential $200 decline or not. Because if I sold out, then I got to figure out, all right, let's say I sell out and it goes higher. How do I get back in? It's tough buying stuff near all-time highs, at least me as a counter-trend trader. That's a hard thing to do. So for now, I'm sitting with it. And a lot of it's going to have to do, Corey, with the dollar. The dollar is still holding above its long-term support line. So for those of you who are listening and have access to the U.S. dollar index, DXY, on most charting systems, if you draw a trend line back from the secular low in 2011, we are somewhere in the upper 91s is that trend line. And we have bounced off of that so far. And for a couple months, we continue to hold support there. If the dollar gives way and breaks down further, then in 2021, I could see it easily going to 87.5. And that's been my downside target in the dollar. So I recognize that, it's going to hold here in the low 90s for a while. But if it breaks, then gold is good. Silver is good. You'll even see perhaps platinum finally come into the foray of being, breakout to the upside. That has stalled multiple times in at around $1,000 and couldn't break out. But now we're still, I see today kind of impressed when I look at the platinum chart. Platinum's back to 950-ish. And I wouldn't have thought that just based upon how much it had gotten trashed recently. So if the dollar falls, precious metals will do well. If the dollar ends up holding here in the low 90s and you get a move up to 95 or 96, they're going to hit the metals hard. And that's where you're going to see pain. And I almost think that might happen just simply to wash some people out, wash weak-handed longs out of the picture. Now, I don't generally talk about Bitcoin. It's not a product. I don't care anything about the cryptos, but it's hard not to recognize that today, Bitcoin is over 18,000 and challenging its all-time highs. And if Bitcoin is doing that, then maybe gold won't fall a heck of a lot, because any of these, a cryptocurrency, or let's call it an alternative asset to actually holding dollars, if Bitcoin's doing this, maybe the dollar just is not going to get a major rally. It's kind of what Bitcoin players are implying by bidding it up to the levels it's had. So it's had a big breakout in the last 2 months that once you got above, I guess, about 10,500 or so, to be at 18,000 this quickly is rather significant. Now, I'm not suggesting your listeners play this market. I don't play cryptos. I don't know if I ever will. But for the time being, I'm not interested in them. But it is, I'm pointing out the fact that $18,000 Bitcoin is something I can't, and it's 18.6. So it's not something I can ignore.
Okay. Hey, Rick, great having you on the show. We covered a lot there, and I think kind of that balance, too, in that first segment about what the disconnect between markets and the underlying economy. That's a key thing to understand, and to understand that stuff like that can continue. Rick, great having you on the show, buddy. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you, Corey. Stay well.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.